Welcome back to the Deep Dive. Today, we are undertaking a pretty extensive examination of a career that, well, feels less like a traditional Hollywood path and more like some kind of carefully executed ongoing artistic heist.
Mm-hmm.
We are diving deep into the world of Crispin Hellion Glover.
Yes.
An actor famous for playing these unforgettable, really eccentric oddballs, but who fundamentally views the mainstream film industry as like a gigantic ATM.
Right, a cash machine.
Used solely to fund his true, deeply personal, and often profoundly bizarre independent art.
That's honestly the perfect frame for it. When you really dig into the source material, you know, the biographical details, the legal fights, his own directing projects, you start to see that George McFly or The Thin Man or even Grendel, they're just kind of avatars, really. They generate the capital. So our mission here is to connect those dots between the very recognizable on-screen work and this strange, wonderful publishing and filmmaking empire he built.
Volcanic eruptions.
Exactly, through volcanic eruptions. It's really a study in deliberate artistic control, where basically every paycheck gets immediately reinvested into, well, challenging the very system that gave it to him.
It's like the ultimate act of subversion, isn't it?
It really is.
He shows up, delivers this genius performance, collects the cash,
takes the money, and runs.
And runs right back to his castle, probably,
yeah,
to make a movie about, say, psychosexual trauma that no studio would ever touch.
Not with a 10-foot pole, no.
So let's unpack this really unconventional journey. Let's try and understand how the foundations of his life kind of set him up for this unique path. And maybe start with one of the most interesting bits, his name.
Right, the name. It's like the theatrical destiny was literally written onto his birth certificate. He was born in New York City in 1964, moved to L.A. when he was about 5.
Okay.
And he carries the full name, Crispin Hellion Glover.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, both of those names are just deeply steeped in performance traditions.
Okay, let's break that down. Crispin, the first name.
Yeah.
That immediately tells you something about the cultural atmosphere he must have grown up in, right?
Definitely.
He was named after the St. Crispin's Day speech from Shakespeare's Henry V.
Yeah, one of the most famous speeches in English literature.
It's this massive literary rallying cry. You know, the king before the Battle of Agincourt trying to inspire his completely outnumbered troops.
Mm-hmm.
To be named after that kind of dramatic historical moment, it sort of suggests a parental expectation of, I don't know, high drama.
Presence. Oh, for sure. And then you get the middle name, Hellion.
Right, Hellion.
Which is maybe even more telling about this sort of intentional eccentricity.
How so?
Well, it wasn't a traditional family name. It was actually adopted by his father, the actor Bruce Glover.
Okay.
Bruce decided to replace his own birth middle name, which was the German name Herbert.
Herbert. Doesn't quite have the same ring.
Not really. Bruce Glover apparently rejected Herbert and replaced it with Hellion, you know, a term for a mischievous or troublesome person.
Yeah.
And Crispin then inherited this deliberately provocative name as his own official middle name. It's almost like a genetic marker for someone who's destined to question things and cause interesting trouble.
Interesting trouble. I like that. And given that sort of theatrical ancestry, it's not really surprising he was immersed in the business from day one.
Not at all. His parents were both performers. His father, Bruce Glover, a character actor, you know, known for roles in films like Diamonds Are Forever and Chinatown.
Classics.
And his mother, Marion Elizabeth Lillian Betty Crashey, she was an actress and a dancer who actually retired when Crispin was born. So, yeah, he basically grew up on sound stages.
The industry was his backyard, essentially.
Exactly. And he started acting professionally remarkably early, like 13 years old.
13, wow.
Yeah. His first recorded role, which kind of demonstrates that theatrical flair we talked about, was playing Friedrich von Trapp in a stage production of The Sound of Music.
No kidding. With who?
Alongside Florence Henderson, believe it or not.
Mrs. Brady.
The very same. That was at the Dorothy Chandler Pavilion, so a pretty high-profile start for a kid.
Definitely. And he didn't just stick to the stage for long, did he? The sources show a really rapid move into TV and film.
Oh, yeah. Very quick. You see him popping up in major iconic 80s sitcoms like Happy Days and Family Ties.
Right. I remember seeing him in Family Ties.
He was a working child actor, you know, constantly auditioning, learning the ropes, refining his craft.
And those early TV gigs, they pretty quickly led to film roles.
Yeah, they translated fast. By 1983, He's in my tutor. Then 1984, he had two pretty notable early appearances. One was in the high school comedy Teachers,
Okay.
and maybe more significantly for that oddball persona he developed, he played the hapless Jimmy in Friday the 13th, the final chapter. You know, the one with the corkscrew.
Oh, that scene. Yes.
Yeah,
Memorable.
exactly. So these early genre roles, they kind of primed him for the massive career-defining moment that was literally just around the corner. A moment that would, well, dictate the entire strategy of his professional life moving forward.
And that moment, obviously, was George McFly in Robert Zemeckis' Back to the Future in 1985.
The big one.
Made him a star overnight. Huge global blockbuster. But this is where that conventional narrative just absolutely shatters, because for Glover, this wasn't really a triumph. It was more of a profound moral conflict.
This is really the absolute key to understanding his entire career. For most actors, playing George McFly, you know, that transition from bullied outsider to confident, wealthy novelist, that's the ultimate wish fulfillment fantasy.
Sure.
But Glover voiced significant objections to the film's ending, like during production.
Okay, let's unpack that conflict. What exactly was his issue with George McFly ending up as this successful novelist living in a huge mansion with a, supportive, wealthy family?
He fundamentally believed that the final sequence, where Marty comes back and finds his parents all successful and rich,
Yeah.
he felt it equated material reward, the nice car, the big house, with moral success.
Oh, okay.
Glover felt that George McFly's evolution should have just stopped at him gaining the self-respect to finally stand up to Biff.
Right, the psychological win.
Exactly. Once the film tied that psychological success directly to financial reward, he felt the underlying message of self-empowerment got corrupted by, well, capitalist ideology.
Wow, that is a really specific and frankly high-minded critique for a mainstream studio film in the mid-80s.
It really is.
And Zemeckis naturally just ignored those complaints.
Pretty much. The sources confirm this artistic disagreement, and that, coupled with a later salary dispute for the sequel,
Right, the money.
that led directly to him not being in part two and part three. Jeffrey Weissman took over the role.
So that dispute basically set his compass going forward.
Absolutely. After that massive success, Glover didn't immediately chase more big paychecks. Instead, his strategy became use the fame as leverage. Find roles that deliberately question the status quo, roles that align with his, you know, intellectual interests.
Which led him pretty quickly to.
To one of his most iconic and disturbing roles, Lane in River's Edge in
Oh,
1986.
yeah. Bleak film.
Just a stunningly bleak film about moral apathy among suburban teens, a complete 180 from George McFly.
And when those really specific, strange, challenging roles weren't readily available, he seemed to adopt a new, very strategic approach,
He did work exclusively with directors whose vision he deeply respected.
which resulted in an incredible run of collaborations in the 90s.
Yeah, with some of the greatest auteurs working then. He was a critical piece of the puzzle in films by David Lynch, playing that absolutely maniacal cousin Del in Wild at Heart in 1990.
Unforgettable role.
He worked with Emir Kusturica on Arizona Dream. And let's focus on something that often gets overlooked. His portrayal of Andy Warhol in Oliver Stone's The Doors in 1991.
That's a crucial detail, isn't it? The sources make it clear he was the very first actor to portray Andy Warhol in a widely released feature film.
The very first.
Yeah.
And that role just perfectly encapsulates his ability to embody these unique, often highly stylized, unsettling cultural figures with this intense, almost alien precision.
He was building this portfolio of roles that satisfied his own curiosity,
Right.
even if they weren't necessarily leading man parts.
Exactly. He continued that path, working with John Borman on Where the Heart Is. And then by the mid-90s, you see films like What's Eating Gilbert Grape in 93, playing Bobby McBurney, and significantly, working with Jim Jarmusch on the brilliant Western Dead Man in 1995,
Great film.
you see a clear pattern. Quality directors, strange roles, intellectual curiosity driving the choices.
But then, around the turn of the millennium, maybe early 2000s, we see that shift we talked about at the beginning, the financial pivot.
Right.
He basically decided that funding his own volcanic eruptions film projects would become the absolute number one factor in accepting any mainstream acting job.
That's exactly when the switch flips. It goes from artistic choice primarily to logistical financing.
Which is why we suddenly see him pop up as the main high-profile antagonist in these massive studio franchises.
Yeah, the most famous example being The Thin Man in Charlie's Angels in 2000, and then the sequel in 2003.
And this is where that control factor becomes really fascinating again. The sources detail that the role of the Thin Man, It was originally a speaking role, right? He had lines, exposition.
He did. It was written with dialogue, probably to explain plot points or whatever.
Yeah.
But Glover went to the producers
Yeah.
and convinced them to eliminate virtually all of his lines.
Why would he do that? Seems counterintuitive.
Because he argued that silence would create a far more precise image. That's the phrase he used.
A precise image.
Yeah. By removing the exposition, the Thin Man transformed. He went from being just some generic henchman into pure silent menace. This genuinely unsettling, almost spectral figure defined entirely by his physicality, his weird gestures, not by any backstory dialogue.
So he maximized his artistic control over the character while simultaneously maximizing his paycheck, knowing exactly where that money was headed.
Precisely. That salary reportedly directly funded the making of his feature directorial debut. What is it?
It's the perfect loop. Use the studio system's cash to finance the anti-studio art.
It's the ultimate efficiency. He continued this pattern, starring as the protagonist in the studio-funded remake of Willard in 2003.
Right, the rat movie.
And then, in maybe the most unexpected twist of all, he reunited with the director who caused that initial moral conflict years earlier, Robert Zemeckis.
Oh, yeah, for Beowulf in 2007. The irony there is just delicious.
Isn't it?
He refuses to be in the Back to the Future sequels over moral and salary issues, only to return to Zemeckis years later using this cutting-edge performance capture technology,
Right.
playing the creature Grendel.
And in typical Glover fashion, his commitment was absolute. He didn't just put on the mocap suit. He spoke all of Grendel's dialogue in Old English.
Seriously, Old English.
Yep. So even in this massive studio production driven by technology, he finds a way to choose a role that demands intense intellectual rigor and commitment to language history. It just reinforces that his involvement is always tied to some kind of higher artistic challenge, not just grabbing a simple paycheck.
And that duality, it just persists, doesn't it? He was the menacing recurring antagonist, Mr. World, in the Starz series American Gods for several years.
Yeah, from 2017 to 2021.
And more recently, he showed up in Guillermo del Toro's Cabinet of Curiosities in that episode Pickman's Model in 2022. He seems to have absolutely perfected the art of being the recognizable face for hire while continually feeding that volcano of his own work.
Okay, so now we really enter the heart of that volcano. Glover established Volcanic Eruptions not just as a production house for his films, but also as the publishing arm for his books.
Right.
And this is where the rules of conventional cinema and literature are just completely thrown out the window.
And maybe the first sign of his resistance to the system is the distribution model itself. You, the listener, you can't just go down to your local multiplex and see one of his films.
No, forget.
They don't get traditional releases at all. Instead, he tours globally with them. He hosts live screenings and performances himself.
This is so critical to understanding his approach. The screening isn't just, pressing play, it's an event. He hosts this pre-show called Big Slideshow based on his books.
Okay.
Then he screens the film. And then afterward, he hosts a really detailed interactive Q&A session, sometimes for hours.
Wow.
It completely transforms the act of viewing. It goes from being this passive experience into an active, almost intimate exchange between him, the artist, and the audience. And this unique method is really the only way he can maintain complete control over the context and, frankly, the interpretation of his very challenging work.
Okay, so let's dive into the core of that directorial output. He refers to this series as the It Trilogy. Part one was his feature debut, What Is It?, which came out in 2005.
Right. What is it is? Well, it's profoundly surreal, often deeply unsettling. It's an exploration of taboos, the limitations of expression. It's probably most infamous for featuring a cast composed almost entirely of actors with Down syndrome.
And the content itself.
The content explores things like sexual desires, cruelty, emotional fragility. It was absolutely designed to challenge and provoke the audience.
That sounds incredibly ambitious, especially for a debut feature. The sources note it took nearly a decade to actually
About
conclude.
10 years, yeah. And made on a shockingly tiny budget, something like $150,000 initially, though it expanded. He shot it on 16 millimeter film stock,
Okay.
which he then intentionally had blown up to 35 millimeter.
Why do that? Is that just budget or is there an artistic reason?
It's both, but definitely artistic too. Shooting on 16 millimeter is cheaper, yes, but blowing it up to 35 millimeter often adds this really pronounced, grainy texture. It gives it a distinct historical, almost found footage aesthetic. It gives the film a visual quality that really matches its deliberately strange, kind of vintage-inspired look. It connects the visual texture directly to that feeling of unearthed, soft, maybe disturbing material.
Got it. Then the second part of the trilogy, it is fine. Everything is fine. Followed in 2007. This film seems to have an equally complex, maybe even more powerful backstory.
Oh, definitely. It was co-directed with David Brothers, but the script, the core of it, came from a writer named Stephen C. Stewart.
And who was Stephen C. Stewart?
Stewart was a Utah writer and actor who had severe cerebral palsy. He lived confined to a nursing home for about 10 years. Glover came across his writing somehow and recognized this profoundly unique, if sometimes disturbing, voice.
Wow.
Stewart's writing became the basis for this fantastical, psychosexual retelling of his own life, exploring his hidden desires, his traumas, his intense frustration with his physical limitations.
And the genesis of that project perfectly illustrates that whole ATM for art idea we talked about.
Absolutely. The sources explicitly detail that the production of It Is Fine was funded mostly by Glover's salary from Charlie's Angels and other mainstream acting roles.
Just think about that for a second. The money he earned playing a silent, leather-clad villain in this glossy studio action movie
Yeah.
was immediately funneled into financing this deeply empathetic, incredibly raw, boundary-pushing film written by a man confined by severe physical disability.
It's an extraordinary connection.
And while those first two parts were shot on 16 millimeter, the next major feature we know about marks a shift. No, you're wrong.
Yeah.
Or spooky action at a distance. And you noted this is not part three of the It trilogy.
Correct. It's a separate project. This one was shot over a much longer period, about 6 years, from 2013 to 2018.
And this film carries intense personal weight, doesn't it? Because it was specifically developed as a vehicle for Crispin and his father, Bruce Glover, to act together.
Yeah, and it ultimately marks Bruce Glover's final film appearance, which is quite poignant. The production also saw Crispin transition to filming on 35mm film stock for the first time with his own projects. That gives it a different visual scale, a different ambition, maybe.
And that ambition extends to the setting, too.
It does. Much of the film was shot on his own property in the Czech Republic, that famous chateau we should probably talk about later.
Okay. And his influences for this kind of work. You mentioned masters of challenging cinema.
Yeah, he lists people like Luis Buñuel, Rainer Werner Fassbinder, Stanley Kubrick, and Werner Herzog. The connection to Herzog is particularly interesting.
How so?
Glover actually participated as a co-interlocutor on the special feature DVD commentaries for two of Herzog's early, very controversial films. Even Dwarf started small in Fata Morgana.
Really?
Yeah, and he used those discussions partly to contextualize his own work, like What Is It?, drawing parallels between Herzog's boundary pushing and his own.
Fascinating. Okay, let's shift then to his publishing efforts, which are totally intertwined with the filmmaking through volcanic eruptions.
Yeah.
He's published, what, 15 to 20 books?
Something like that, yeah.
Yeah.
With these strange, evocative titles like Rat Catching and Oakmott. But the creation process is where the real Glover-esque genius lies. It's basically literary collage.
How does that work?
He finds these old public domain novels, often from the 19th century. For example, Rat Catching used an 1896 book on actual rat catching, and Oakmott used an 1868 novel.
Okay, so he finds these old books.
And then he physically alters the found text. He'll rearrange paragraphs. He blacks out existing passages with thick marker. He adds his own surreal, sometimes disturbing prose and images right into the margins or even over the existing text.
So wait, he's not writing a book in the traditional sense.
Yeah.
He's taking an existing artifact and just violently recontextualizing it.
Exactly. To create a new, unsettling narrative that speaks to his own specific obsessions.
Wow.
It's an act of appropriation, but also recreation. And these physical books, they aren't just meant to sit silently on a shelf somewhere.
Right, they tie into the live show.
Precisely. They are essential elements in his touring big slideshow. He reads sections aloud, often performing them quite dramatically, while projecting the modified visual art and text onto a screen behind him. So the books, the films, the performance, the production, it all feeds back into that unique, completely self-contained ecosystem of volcanic eruptions, hashtag 5EFE, public incidents, and legal legacy, the unpredictable.
Okay, so given his absolute dedication to the surreal, the provocative, and this highly controlled sense of performance, it feels almost inevitable that his public life has sometimes blurred those lines between genuine eccentricity and, well, deliberate artistic performance. And the gold standard for that ambiguity has got to be his appearance on Late Night with David Letterman back in 1987.
Oh, yeah, the infamous one. At the time, he was supposedly there to promote River's Edge.
Right.
And you have to remember, late night television in the late 80s was generally much more conventional than it is now, which made this event stand out even more dramatically.
So what happened? For anyone who hasn't seen the clip.
Glover appeared wearing this clearly fake, terrible wig, platform shoes. He acted incredibly erratically, seemed to be speaking in some kind of bizarre character. And then, most memorably, he launched this high kick that came incredibly close to hitting Letterman right in the face during some agitated demonstration he was doing. The moment became instantly infamous. Letterman was completely bewildered, clearly unnerved. He actually walked off the set to cue the top 10 list.
We walked off.
Walked right off. It was a PR disaster for the network, probably, but it became this viral sensation decades before viral was even a thing.
And the confusion lingered for years, right? Was this a genuine breakdown? Was he on something mentally disturbed?
Exactly. That speculation swirled for years. But it shifted significantly about 4 years later when his film, Reuben and Ed, finally premiered.
Okay, how did that change things?
Because in that film, he plays the titular character, Reuben Farr. And Reuben Farr's appearance, including the bad wig, the platform shoes, the highly agitated mannerisms, it closely matched the behavior everyone saw on the Letterman show.
Ah, so the theory developed.
The theory developed, yeah.
Yeah.
And the character Reuben Farr also appeared in Glover's own music video for his song Clowny Clown Clown,
Okay.
which strongly suggested that the whole Letterman appearance wasn't a breakdown at all, but a planned, incredibly aggressive piece of performance art.
Bringing a character onto the late night stage.
Yeah, potentially to promote a film that wouldn't even be released for several more years.
But that raises a pretty profound question, doesn't it? If it was performance art, doesn't that make the line between artistic expression and, I don't know, public integrity incredibly muddy? He deliberately created a moment of genuine fear and confusion on live national TV.
It's a really tricky ethical line, and Glover, decades later, he still refuses to confirm or deny the theory. He just says he's flattered that fans continue to speculate about it.
Of course he does.
That intentional ambiguity is just fundamental to his whole brand. He wants the audience constantly questioning what's real and what's the act.
Okay, but moving beyond maybe performance art pranks, Glover's resistance to Hollywood actually created a monumental, completely non-ambiguous legal legacy that reshaped the entire industry.
Yes.
This is the fallout from the Back to the Future Part 2 sequel situation.
This is perhaps his single greatest unexpected contribution to the collective rights of all actors. It's huge. When the producers wanted George McFly back for the sequels,
Yeah.
they didn't want to meet Glover's financial demands, and they probably didn't want to deal with his artistic complaints again. So they basically decided to just circumvent him entirely.
Okay, tell us specifically what they did, because it sounds like it was a really deliberate act of deceit
Yeah.
designed to fool the audience.
It absolutely was. They took brief original footage of Glover from the first film,
Right.
and they combined it with extensive new footage featuring a different actor, Jeffrey Weissman,
Playing George McFly.
playing George McFly. But they used heavy facial prosthetics on Weissman. They obscured him with sunglasses. They used specific rear shots, low lighting, basically every trick in the book to simulate Glover's appearance without actually paying him or getting his permission.
They were literally trying to trick the audience into thinking Crispin Glover was performing those new scenes.
100%. And to add insult to injury, they gave him the subtle credit like George McFly in footage from Back to the Future, without clearly indicating that the vast majority of the performance in Part 2 was actually done by a double wearing prosthetics.
Unbelievable.
Glover sued the producers successfully for using his likeness without permission.
And he won.
Well, it settled out of court, but he was awarded a reported $760,000. But honestly, the actual dollar amount is far less important than the so what factor, the precedent this set for all performers moving forward.
Okay, so what was the specific legal change that came out of this BTTF2 lawsuit?
As a direct result of that lawsuit, new clauses were added to the Screen Actors Guild SAG collective bargaining agreements.
What did they say?
These clauses specifically prevent producers and actors from using those kinds of techniques, what's often called the fake Shemp technique, to reproduce the likeness of other living actors without permission and compensation.
Okay, we should probably pause and explain that term, fake Shemp, for listeners who might not know it. It's a piece of old Hollywood history, isn't it?
It is, yeah. The term originates from the Three Stooges when one of the Stooges, Shemp Howard, died suddenly.
Right.
The producers still had contractual obligations for more shorts, so they finished them by using body doubles, often seen from the back, or with their faces obscured by objects or hidden in shadows, combined with recycled footage of the real Shemp.
Gotcha.
Glover's lawsuit basically codified that this kind of cheap trick could not be used against living, working actors to reproduce their image without their consent and without paying them for it.
That is absolutely massive. The guy who objected to the perceived moral failure of Back to the Future's ending in 1985 ends up creating this vital ethical and legal precedent that is arguably more important now than ever before.
You're absolutely right. With the rise of deepfake technology, generative AI, digital recreation of actors.
It's everywhere now.
That specific SAG clause, which exists because a studio tried to avoid paying Crispin Glover what he asked for, has become a foundational line of defense. It protects performers' ownership of their own visual likeness in the digital age.
He resisted Hollywood's lack of ethics on his own terms, and in doing so, he secured a crucial right for all his colleagues decades later.
It's incredible. That lawsuit perfectly encapsulates the strategic impact of his often quiet but deeply principled resistance. #VZXShag, secondary artistic outlets, and private life.
Now, Glover's artistic energy, it's not just confined to film and publishing, is it? It flows into music as well.
Yeah.
And it maintains that same level of deliberate, unsettling eccentricity.
Oh, absolutely. During a hiatus from films, he actually released an album back in 1989.
What was it called?
The title is Pure Glover. The big problem does not equal the solution. The solution equals Let It Be.
Chuckles. Okay, that tracks.
The album was produced by Barnes & Barnes, who are known for their own brand of musical oddity, like the song Fish Heads.
Ah, okay. Makes sense.
And the tracklist itself is just an essential piece of the overall Crispin Grotto puzzle. It features original songs like Clowny Clown Clown, which, as we mentioned, ties back into that Reuben Farr character from Reuben and Ed in the Letterman appearance. It also features readings from his art books like Rat Catching and Oak Mott. And then there's a series of just deeply strange cover songs.
And these covers, they seem designed to provoke and confuse, right? We're talking about covering Lee Hazelwood's These Boots Are Made for Walkin', alongside incredibly Charles Manson's song, I'll Never Say Never to Always.
Which Glover sang entirely in falsetto.
Falsetto, wow.
Yeah. So reading his recontextualized 19th century literature out loud and covering Charles Manson in a high-pitched voice, I mean, that's a bizarre high-concept artistic menu. It's absolutely designed to make people uncomfortable, make them think twice about what they're consuming. It just confirms that the performance of the perpetual outsider is complete and permeates everything.
And he also used his musical output as a direct tie-in for his 2003 film Willard, didn't he?
He did. He recorded a cover of the Michael Jackson song Ben,
which was the theme song from the sequel to the original Willard back in the 70s.
Exactly. The sequel was called Ben, so he covered that song. And he directed the music video for it himself.
Okay, and what was the video like, knowing Glover?
Predictably strange, it features him singing directly to a rat, presumably Ben, but in the background, he deliberately incorporated this highly provocative historical imagery.
Such as?
His Willard co-star, the late, great R. Lee Ermey.
Gunny Hartman.
Right. Ermey appears portraying three distinct male characters, all of whom resemble controversial figures from mid-20th century history, the filmmaker Eric von Stroheim, the actor Emil Jannings, and, most controversially, Adolf Hitler.
Wait, Hitler? In a music video for a song about a pet rat?
Yep.
Why? Why introduce Hitler imagery into that context? It seems like such an unnecessary risk, unless maybe the provocation is the entire point.
I think the provocation is the point. Just like his use of actors with Down syndrome in What Is It? Or the bizarre text collages in his books, he's forcing the audience to confront uncomfortable historical and cultural figures, often within an otherwise benign or even sentimental context, like a song about a rat.
It demands interpretation.
Exactly. It ensures the art cannot be passively consumed or easily dismissed. You have to react, even if it's just confusion or discomfort.
Okay. Finally, we need to talk a little about his private residence, because it seems to perfectly mirror his dedication to these long-term, overwhelming projects. He maintains places in L.A. and NYC, but his main home base is in the Czech Republic.
That's right. He owns Zámek Konarovice. It's a 17th-century chateau, sits on about 20 acres, maybe 45 minutes east of Prague.
Wow, a 17th-century chateau.
And it's not just some fancy house. It's actually recognized as historically significant by the Czech government.
It sounds like a dream retreat on one hand. But given its age, it must also be just an unending source of logistical nightmares, upkeep, repairs.
That seems to be exactly how he views it. It is the ultimate project. He talks about the chateau not really as a luxury residence, but as this massive ongoing artistic responsibility that demands constant upkeep.
He sees the upkeep as part of the art.
Almost. He describes the property as a lifetime project. He's quoted as saying, "It will be in continuous flux and repair for hundreds of years from now, as it has been the hundreds of years before I owned it."
So it's this unending commitment, just like his decades-long film projects or book series.
Exactly. It perfectly mirrors his commitment to his career and his art. The sources also mention, interestingly, that he remains single. He cited his intense career demands as a reason he feels sort of unfit to be a father, believing a father should be constantly present for his children.
Mm.
His commitment to the work, whether it's maintaining a 17th century castle in Bohemia or filming a challenging psychosexual drama over 6 years, it seems to be absolutely total. #, outro, summary, and final thought.
So wrapping this up, what really stands out most profoundly in this deep dive is, I think, the strategic brilliance of Crispin Glover.
He's not really a compromised artist, is he? He's more like a strategically funded one.
That's a great way to put it. He absolutely perfected the technique of using the studio system, the very thing he critiques, as a means to generate the income required to fund the profoundly unique, independent, and yes, sometimes unnervingly bizarre art that he creates through volcanic eruptions.
He maintains this incredible duality, this true, like, bifurcated career. He's the recognizable face who delivers an iconic, highly controlled performance for a studio.
Gets the check,
and then immediately uses that salary to bankroll, say, a decade-long film project about the complexity of identity, or to publish books he surgically recontextualized from the 1800s. The chaos you might perceive is intentional. The method underneath is incredibly precise.
And beyond the art itself, we really have to always circle back to the long-term impact of his resistance. That Back to the Future Part 2 lawsuit, it established such a crucial legal boundary for actors. It secured their rights against the misuse of their visual likeness.
Which is more relevant than ever. Exponentially more vital. In an era dominated by AI, deepfakes, digital recreation, that specific protection is becoming fundamental to every working performer in Hollywood. He fought for himself, and he ended up protecting the entire industry in the process.
So what did this all mean for you, the listener? I guess it means the eccentricity you see is intentional, the rebellion is strategic, and those mainstream roles, they're often merely logistical steps toward a much purer, much stranger artistic end.
Exactly. And if you want one final thought to kind of mull over after this, consider the unpublished 500-page novel he apparently wrote throughout the 2010s.
I got you 2 pages.
Yeah. Its primary focus is reported to be on propaganda within the American entertainment industry, and it apparently weaves in elements of his own work and his own experiences. He created this massive, dense statement of critique against the very system he occasionally participates in, like a final large volcano of thought just sitting there waiting to erupt.